the studios of Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP, in Santa Cruz, California, I'm Gary Shapiro, and this is From the Bookshelf. It's always a pleasure to welcome James Kaplan back to the show. His biography of Frank Sinatra, Frank the Voice, which covers the first half of Sinatra's life, is now out in paperback, and that seemed like a great excuse to get James Kaplan on From the Bookshelf again. Frank the Voice is the best book yet on Sinatra, and if you haven't read it, then as soon as we're done talking, you should start. James Kaplan, welcome back to From the Bookshelf.
Oh man, with words like that, Gary, I'm thrilled to be here anyway, but doubly thrilled. Thank you so much for that high praise.
Are you now entrenched in the second half of Sinatra's life?
I'm thinking hard about the very different second half of Sinatra's life, and what a different project it is, and what a different person he became, even while, of course, he was the same. We all remain the same throughout our lives, but he had so many acts to his lives, that was a Freudian slip, because with Sinatra, you really are talking about lives. You're talking about different lives, from Axel Stordahl to Nelson Riddle to Billy May to from Nancy Sinatra to Ava Gardner to God knows who to Mia Farrow.
Yeah.
You know, it's so many lives, and yet there is just as the voice deepened and became this oaken baritone as the Capitol years proceeded, there was a change in Sinatra too, and I do feel as though the second book is a different book, and I must say a somewhat darker book.
You know, I was thinking about your book and your earlier book that you wrote about Dean Martin. You co-wrote, or you helped, I don't know how you say it, you ghost-wrote Jerry Lewis's.
I channeled, yes.
It's a wonderful book, and that's another one everybody should read, Dean and Me, A Love Story by Jerry Lewis and my guest, James Kaplan. And of course, Dean is a complex figure who figures prominently in Frank Sinatra's life.
Yes. Yes, they loved each other.
And in your other book, Jerry says that Dean just continued to do the same act that he had done for 10 years with Martin and Lewis. He just substituted Frank and Sammy for Jerry.
In a way. I think that certainly Frank Sinatra and Jerry Lewis are very different people and very different senses of humor, although I guess you might compare some of Jerry's more extreme slapstick to Frank's adventures with cherry bombs. But he didn't throw the cherry bombs on stage, and he and Dean made the kind of pair that Jerry and Dean, I think, progressively had trouble with throughout their partnership. I think that it was easier between Frank and Dean.
Well, the moment that made me think of you and your next volume is I was reviewing that classic scene when Frank brings Dean and Jerry back together after 20 years. And the clip that they always show and recently showed on the Jerry Lewis special they had on cable is the clip at the moment when Frank brings Dean out and Dean and Jerry hug, and it's really beautiful. But if you watch the whole thing, what happens next is that Frank doesn't, you know, gently walk off stage and leave the two of them to have a moment together. Mm. He kind of anxiously waits for them to be through hugging so that he and Dean can do their number. It's almost like he's a little bit jealous, a little bit...
He's
waiting to get back in the spotlight.
You bet. That's where he wanted to be and deserved to be. And triangles don't work anywhere. That's a fascinating several minutes of footage. And you can break it down. You can microanalyze it moment by moment by moment by moment.
What do you think was more complex, Sinatra's relationships with women or with men?
Boy, there's a question. I think with men. I think that he had really an absent father. His father was physically absent. His father was emotionally absent. He was a pleasant man, but he was monosyllabic. He was illiterate functionally, Marty Sinatra was, and he spent most of his day in the firehouse. Now, that's not to say that, he was in the Hoboken Fire Department. It's not to say that Dolly wasn't gone a lot, too, but Dolly had a much firmer hand when it came to Frank's upbringing. So I'm waffling here because Dolly's relationship with her son, Frank's relationship with his mother, conditioned all his subsequent relationships with women. And I think, I'm not sure if we can quantify complexity exactly, but what I can tell you is that his uncertainty about his relationship with his mother, because he always said, "I never knew whether she was going to hug me or hit me," and he meant it because she was capable of either, really passed along to his relationships afterwards with women and lent them an uncertainty that was very difficult. It was very difficult for Sinatra to have a truly intimate relationship with a woman. With the men, there were subsequent father figures, successive father figures. There was Tommy Dorsey, and there was Manny Sachs of Columbia Records, and Axel Stordahl was a kind of father figure to Sinatra. They were very important to him. And then there were the friends. There was Hank Santacola, who was with him from the beginning, and they broke up acrimoniously over the Calneva Casino. And then, of course, there was Gilly Rizzo in the latter part of Sinatra's life. I'm giving you a very long-winded answer to your question and trying to figure it out as I jabber along, but I think that I had a long interview, many interviews actually, with a woman named Peggy Connolly, who you may not remember, but she was a pretty well-known jazz and pop singer in the mid-50s, and she became Sinatra's girlfriend for several years, post-Ava. She looked a little bit like Ava. She was a knockout. She was dark-haired. She wasn't the same kind of knockout that Ava was, like a once-in-a-millennium knockout, but she was a knockout anyway. And I had many enjoyable hours talking with Peggy Connolly, and it was hard to find. She spent a lot of time with Sinatra, very intimate circumstances, and she was his main lady for a while. It was hard to find the intimacy between them. She would talk about him fondly, and I don't think with bitterness after all those years, but it was hard to pick out the intimacy. I think that there was a kind of intimacy with his male friends that there wasn't with his girlfriends.
In The Voice, you mentioned that Peggy Connolly touched Frank's scar, and he flinched.
Yeah, he recoiled. And that was a very intimate touch, I think more intimate perhaps than a sexual touch in a way. It was getting to the seat of Sinatra's vulnerability, and his vulnerability was the essence of his art. It was his soul. It was something that he had severely mixed feelings about. You know, he was deep inside, Sinatra was a quivering flower, really. He was the world's most sensitive man, incredibly intelligent, incredibly intuitive. And he, of course, masked it and cloaked it and girded it with this rough, spiny exterior. And at that moment, Peggy Connolly was sort of touching the vulnerability, and it really bothered him.
Sinatra, and of course we never know, you probably know, but nobody knows whether these stories are true or what the deal is, but it seemed like he would, when he got in a fight with a man, he would drop them, like Peter Lawford, I guess, was one.
Yeah.
And he never wanted to speak to them again. And of course he would also be cold and drop women, like, having divorce papers served to Mia Farrow without even discussing it with her.
Yeah.
But at the same time with women, like his first wife, Nancy, he remained close to his whole life. And when Mia Farrow was having problems with Woody Allen, he said, "Should I have his legs broken?" or something like that.
Yes, no, he did. He literally said that. apparently. It was easier for him to be charitable and loving at a distance than it was close up. That's the long and short of it. So with these very central figures in his life, with Big Nancy Sinatra, his first wife, Nancy Barbado Sinatra, his first wife, and with Ava Gardner, with Mia Farrow, with the women who were important to him, he wasn't so great in the clinch. He wasn't so great one-on-one and when they were together, but once they were apart, it was easier for him. And he, of course, stories abound about his many magnanimous charitable acts. That was the kind of thing that worked for him. What was hardest was to be together in one spot with somebody for an extended period of time. He wanted out of there. He wanted on to the next sensation.
We're talking with James Kaplan, and his biography of Frank Sinatra is called Frank, The Voice, and it's now out in paperback, and you can get it on your Kindle if you want. Barbara Sinatra was, I guess, the wife that he was married to the longest.
Yeah,
even longer than he was married to his first wife.
Yeah.
And she just recently wrote a book. Did you read it? Do you have any
feelings
about it?
What I did. Well, I read a lot of it. I must confess, I didn't finish it. I found myself getting somewhat impatient with...
Sinatra dies in the end. Oh, I gave it away.
Oh, you did, yeah. It does not have a happy ending. But I could hold forth about my quibbles with the book. I will just say that I grew impatient with the cataloging of jewelry. Sometimes I felt as though there were a loop fixed in Ms. Sinatra's eye while she was writing this book, and the cataloging of social connections. It just didn't feel to me. I felt as though a far more penetrating book about Sinatra, from an intimate standpoint, was Mr. S, was George Jacobs, the valet's memoir of Sinatra. There, I really felt you were getting the man. And with Barbara Sinatra, I constantly had my shaker of salt at the ready.
Well, do you think Frank is different? He's actually different around men than he is around women. Or were there any women, Shirley MacLaine or whatever, that he was the same as he was with his pals?
I think that, and Shirley MacLaine wrote a wonderful memoir, My Lucky Stars, that is incredibly, boy, is she smart, incredibly penetrating about Dean Martin, whom Shirley had a huge crush on, and about Sinatra. Some of the best stuff that's ever been written about Sinatra is in that book. And by the way, wonderful stuff about Sinatra and Tina Sinatra's book about her father, My Father's Daughter. I think that while he probably didn't have a sexual relationship with Shirley MacLaine and sort of treated her like one of the boys, maybe she got to see that side of him more closely than any other woman.
Well, I've already said how much I enjoy your book, but I want to ask you this question. The New York Times, they wrote a review of your book a while back, and they kind of accused you of fictionalizing the biography. Did you make up a whole lot of stuff in your book?
No, I didn't make up anything in my book. Actually, I think that I guess you're talking about the Times book review as opposed to the Daily review.
Yeah.
Which was a less good review, and of course, being an author, I thought a less smart review. No, I didn't make anything up. I think that a lot of the people who had trouble with feeling that I had fictionalized things really had trouble with the style of the book. I wanted to write a different kind of book about Sinatra, and different in several senses. I wanted to write a book that... that was not about the women and the mob and the fist fights, that was not about the gossip. I felt that had been done many times, and it was time to move on to something else. And as I've said, the book really flowed out of my book with Jerry Lewis, going to the telethon and going out to dinner with this group of musicians who had all worked with Sinatra, and were in their cups late in the evening and talking with awe about what a musical genius he was. And I thought, well, you know, that sort of gave me goosebumps. I thought, that's fascinating. We kind of knew that. But here are guys who could have said anything about him and gossiped, if they wanted to, about the women and the mob and the fist fights. But the first thing they want to talk about is what a genius he is. So I wanted to try to get the genius on the page. And last, I wanted to try and give to a biography the narrative propulsion of fiction. That doesn't mean any of it was fiction. If I animated a scene, I spent innumerable hours looking up weather records for Los Angeles, for New York in the 1940s and the 1950s, just trying to figure out what it felt like, what it looked like, what was going on. And so when I animated a scene, I knew very well what it felt like to be there, and when I described Sinatra's state of mind, I was describing his state of mind as those who had been with him described it. So there was every bit of dialogue was I didn't speak to Sinatra, so it wasn't firsthand, but every bit of dialogue was from a reputable source, was well sourced. I think when people talk about fictionalization, again, it's a matter of tone. And those who like the book a lot like that style. They really felt they were pulled along by it. Those who didn't weren't.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the music and the genius. You and I have talked before about the Columbia years and how really the Capitol years is where he becomes a true musical genius, I guess, as a vocalist. And now you're writing about the Reprise years, which were longer than the Capitol years, and they contain some of his best and arguably his worst recordings. I mean, he kind of felt the need to stay current and record Winchester Cathedral and Don't Sleep in the Subway, Darling, and Bad Leroy Brown. But at the same time, sometimes he really struck gold there, like his MacArthur Park on Trilogy, for instance. Well, in Frank the Voice, you brought some overlooked recordings to our attention, like Day In, Day Out on the Nice and Easy reissue. So have you discovered anything that we need to hear?
I'm going to waffle a little bit because I am deep into my Reprise research. I've been in touch miraculously with a man named Mo Austin, and Mo Austin was the first head of Reprise Records. And so he is just, he's still with us. He's sharp as a tack. He's 85, 86 years old. He's the most fabulous resource. And so we are just, I spent three delectable hours with Mo Austin in Los Angeles the week before last, talking about how Sinatra began that label. And we are just getting into the recording sessions. So I hate to give you a to be continued, but I certainly have my Reprise favorites, as everybody else does. But as for secrets, as for new discoveries, I'm still making them.
Well, I'll tell you mine, but no, not right now. When you come back for volume two, we'll talk about that. But let's just hit some of the Reprise years hits and get your take on some of them.
Yeah.
I guess probably the biggest Reprise hit he ever had was pretty late, and that was My Way, right before his 1971 retirement.
Yes.
And I remember when My Way came out, there was a barbershop in West Hollywood, and at their own expense, they created this huge banner and put it out, "Congratulations, Frank Sinatra, on My Way." I mean, he inspired a lot of love in his fans. But what's your take on that record?
Well, it's not a record that Sinatra, it's a complicated story. I actually participated in a wonderful BBC documentary on that song. It was an hour about My Way. It's well worth listening to if you can find it. It's a complicated matter. It's a song that Sinatra really never liked that much. And yet, Sinatra was a man who was always a singer who was always looking for a hit. He was always almost desperate to find a hit, and in many ways, to Frank Sinatra, it didn't matter if the song was his favorite. If it was a hit, that was what he was after. And My Way, of course, was a huge hit. He quickly grew tired of it. He felt that. And another complication of the story is that I want to express great respect for Paul Anka as an artist, as a singer, as a lyricist, and I feel that in adapting the French song into Sinatra's theme song, that Paul Anka wrote a very shall we say serviceable lyric. That was, for Sinatra's taste and for mine, too on the nose. It had a braggadocio about it. It said exactly what it meant, like that flag. It was very much like waving a flag, that song. And Sinatra was, as I said, an incredibly smart guy who had a great connoisseurship of fine lyrics, and was had the privilege to sing some of the greatest lyrics of all time: Cole Porter, Lorenz Hart, Irving Berlin. My Way isn't up there with those, but it was a powerful song, and it remains a powerful song because it's a work of fiction. It's a work of fiction in the minds of the beholders, the minds of the audience. It creates the fiction that here is this all-powerful figure, Frank Sinatra, who is able to have it his way, and he's telling us exactly how he did that and how proud he is about it. Sinatra didn't feel those things. He didn't feel them when he sang them, and he wanted to feel the song that he sang, and he wanted to make you feel it. And because he couldn't really feel that about My Way, he couldn't make the audience feel it the way he. It was frustrating to him. So he could express it. He could project it. He could be very effective at communicating that lyric. But ultimately, he felt it was two-dimensional, and I agree.
Two people who covered that song, you know, the thing is, when Sinatra said the end is near, in fact, the end was nowhere near. But
yeah.
But two people who covered that song, one Elvis Presley and the other Sid Vicious,
yeah.
The end was very near for both of
very
them.
Very near for both, yeah. That was a very sad thing. And yeah, they're both kind of wonderful renditions because we can project that history onto them. But also there's something... I don't know. There's something kind of delicious about each of those, even delicious about Sid Vicious.
Mm-hmm. It's true. One of my favorite reprise records, and now, you know, I think it doesn't have the same kind of impact that it had when it first hit the radio, but That's Life really didn't sound like Frank. It sounded like a Ray Charles record.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Well, That's Life, that's something I did recently discuss with Mo Austin, and That's Life, of course, had a wonderful story to it. And the story was that Reprise had brought in a producer named Jimmy Bowen. Jimmy Bowen used to be a sort of country and western artist himself, a singer and an instrumentalist. And Jimmy Bowen was a terrific producer, a really smart guy. He was deeply country. He had a southern accent you could cut with a knife, and contrary to those who foolishly think that a southern accent indicates lack of intelligence, Jimmy Bowen was sharp as a tack. He produced Dean Martin. Help me here a second. Dean Martin's Everybody Loves Somebody,
oh, right.
Right? And so I'm getting to That's Life, but there's a wonderful story about Dean Martin and Jimmy Bowen. And Dean Martin didn't want to sing Everybody Loves Somebody the way he ended up singing. Of course, it became one of the biggest hits of, a mega hit. And it became a mega hit because of what Jimmy Bowen did to it. Dean wanted to do it slower and more soulfully. And Bowen pepped it up, and he had a certain figure that he played on the piano, 1-2-3, 1-2-3, and Dean Martin says to Jimmy Bowen, "What's that?" And Jimmy Bowen says to Dean Martin, "Them's triplets." So Jimmy Bowen meets Frank Sinatra, right? And Sinatra, rock and roll is coming in. It's coming in, and Sinatra is genteelly put it, he's peeved. He hates rock and roll.
I can't remember the quote exactly, but it's made by cretins and.
Yeah. Right. Cretinous vermin or whatever he said. But he is, and it is. Right. It is. What did he say? Oh yeah, he was talking about Elvis. His kind of music is deplorable, a rancid smelling aphrodisiac, I think he said. That's one thing he said. So he hates rock and roll. Rock and roll is coming in. It is That's Life is what? Is it December 65? It's right around the end of 65, beginning of 66, I believe, off the top of my head. I'm sure somebody out in radio land is jumping up and down saying, "No,
he's wrong.
He's wrong." But it's right at that cusp, you know. It's at that moment when the Beatles have launched this nuclear device and destroyed music as Sinatra knew it. The ripples, it's more than ripples, it's a tsunami, and everybody around Sinatra is drowning, and Mel Torme is thinking that he's got to change professions and become a commercial airline pilot because he can't make a living singing anymore. The music business is turning upside down. Sinatra is angry, and Jimmy Bowen is there to try and help him get a hit, and with more upbeat music. And so he brings him, they bring in That's Life, and Sinatra does a take of it. He does a take of it, and Sinatra, you know, he would do many takes of a song if that's what it took and if he was in the mood. He was different about his recording than he was about his movies. Movies, it was one take, and he was out of there no matter what. But with his songs, a lot of the time it was one take. That was the way he preferred it. But if it needed it, as in I've Got You Under My Skin, he would do 22 to get it right. With That's Life, he wasn't that fond of the song, and he wanted a hit, and he did a take, and he turned to Jimmy Bowen, who was there in the booth, and said, "Okay." And Jimmy Bowen said, "Yeah, it was pretty good." Well, you don't say that to Sinatra. And Sinatra was furious. And so what you hear is the second take of That's Life with a furious Sinatra biting off the syllables and pounding out that song. And it gives it this energy and this drive. You know, That's Life is just, it's 38 times the song that My Way is. It's a terrific song. It holds up.
It really holds up.
You can hear the anger in his voice. You can hear the power of that rendition, and it is just, it's just one of those goosebump numbers every time.
Well, the reprise years really do have some, now that I'm thinking about them all, yeah, one of the forgotten ones, I don't know if people ever even heard it, is that wonderful record called Cycles. I think that's a really remarkable performance, a country song, really, by Frank.
Yeah, I was just thinking of the latter day, the reprise version that Sinatra did of All or Nothing at All.
Yeah, that's really great.
With that incredible organ on it, I think the same...
It's the same kind of Ray Charles sound.
Well, it's the same organist that was on Summer Wind.
Mm-hmm.
And it is just as All or Nothing at All back in the 40s was great. It's equally great in the 60s in a different way.
The song Is You. That's a song he recorded so many times, and the very last time he did it, it's on Trilogy, he nails it.
Yeah,
in 1980.
You were in 1980, and he also did a soliloquy that was monumental when he himself was close to 80.
Yeah,
You know, when he finally owned that song. You know, he first tried soliloquy when he was too young
at Columbia, right?
Yeah, at Columbia, and he didn't own it yet.
Yeah. Well, I can't tell you how much I'm looking forward to Volume 2. When will we see it?
Well, it is officially due, Gary, I think it's spring of 2014. Every time I say that date, it sounds like the Jetsons, you know?
That's right. We'll be taking our tubes, you know.
Yeah, right. But it's not that far away.
Radio will still be in business then.
I think so, in some form, perhaps implanted in our skins in a chip or something. But it's not that far away. You know, it's just a couple of years.
Well, James Kaplan, I hope we get a chance to talk again on From the Bookshelf before then. But thank you so much for being with us this time.
Thank you so much, Gary.
That's all the time we have for From the Bookshelf this week. I hope you enjoyed the program and that you'll come back and see us again next time. In the meantime, you can check out our podcast page at KUSP.org or find us on iTunes and Facebook. Production assistance on From the Bookshelf is provided by Francis Venegas. Thank you, Francis. I want to thank James Kaplan for being my guest. His newest book, now out in paperback, Frank Sinatra, Frank the Voice. It's a fabulous book. You should go read it right now. For From the Bookshelf, I'm Gary Shapiro. See you next time.